foundational teachers and wisdom traditions conveyed his message or his teachings by way of similes and metaphors, moving from things which were known and familiar to the people who were listening to what he had to say, to a different way of looking things, a different way of understanding the nature of mind, of understanding what's going on when we watch the mind. So simile means like similar to. So the Buddha would talk about, and one of the similes that he used, that being a self-aversive type has always really resonated with me, is he said that, you know, the self-aversive personality is like a dog with a collar around its neck chained to a post, relentlessly lunging against his imprisonment, lunging against the tether, okay? And all of the energy that goes into lunging against the tether does nothing more than injure his neck. And so it's that very energy of being aversive to that which you don't like about yourself which causes the pain, you know? And that when the mindfulness gets strong enough that, you know, you can, instead of being so identified with the person that doesn't like something about her or himself, you know, that you can just expand the picture until you can see the dog and the collar and the chain and the post to which it's attached and the whole dynamic, right? It's like, wow, okay. When you're looking at it not from the standpoint of the tethered dog, but from the standpoint of this sort of compassionate overview, then the whole scenario starts to get disempowered. It just starts to weaken. It starts to have less meaning, less vibrance, you know, until you realize that, right, I am the dog, and I am the collar, and I am the chain, and I am the post, and I am that which is revolting against who I am, and I am the one who is watching this dynamic occur. And then once the thing, once the mind is expanded to that realm, to that point, you know, to that kind of all-encompassing mindfulness and insight, then the whole scene just collapses, right? It becomes disempowered, and it becomes seen for what it is, which is just this melodrama, you know, in which we are no longer so personally invested in being the dog. And it's really simple simile, right? But with tremendous power. And so similes, one thing similar to another. And then the other main form of working, moving from, that he used, moving from that which is known to that which he is seeking to help people envision. It's what's called metaphors. Metaphor, meta, big, you know, taking, creating a whole different or new way of envisioning a dynamic, not just the dog and the collar and the chain and the post, but the entirety of a kind of a cosmological view. And so in, you know, in Buddha Dharma, in the Theravada tradition, the Southern Buddhist tradition, the probably the most ancient one, that is extant, you know, within a couple, 300 years of the Buddha's lifetime in Southeast Asia and Southern Asia. Um, among the great metaphors, you know, there are these kind of core seminal teachings that the Buddha offered. He lived and taught for about 45 years, and you know, there are very interesting similarities and distinctions between Siddhartha Gautama and Jesus of Nazareth. You know, Jesus was he was a peasant, and he lived among people that, you know, the 99% working class, you know, great. After he started teaching, for the most part, he was homeless. He wandered from town to town, hung out with people and taught people that had no power, no influence. And so as a result, as soon as the power structure found him to be an affliction or an irritation, they had, of course, to whack him. The Buddha was a one percenter. You know, he came from a very high rank in Indian society. And when he, you know, went into self-examination and began to teach, he quickly attracted a following of people from a wide range of Indian society, from the top to the bottom. And he also quickly began to attract benefactors who were extremely wealthy and provided shelter for he and his retinue. And so things took off in a completely different direction from the starting point. So he had much more of an opportunity to share his teachings over a long period of time. But both Jesus and the Buddha, over the course of their teaching lifetimes, there were a few seminal teachings that they offered that became like, whoa, okay, those are the ones that we're going to hang our hat on. For Jesus, among those kind of seminal or kind of mothership teachings was the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. Right? And so kind of a rough corollary to that for the Buddha was the Greater Discourse on the Establishing of Mindfulness, also known as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. And in that discourse, in that teaching, he laid out what has been called, ever since that time, the direct path to realization. He said, if you do these meditation practices, one after another, you know, in sequence going forward, you can move from a point of having no knowledge of the nature of mind to a place of complete awakening. And he set out the stepwise means by which this can be done. And so every October, we go through that discourse together, kind of lay it out. Beginning with mindfulness of breathing in the body, just kind of being here, being this physical thing in this physical world, to looking at the way the mind very quickly decides what it likes, doesn't like, and doesn't care about, and then looking at the contents of the mind in terms of, you know, thoughts and feelings, looking at the mind's ability to begin to discern how it creates suffering for itself. Okay. And then as he, in this progressive teaching of the practice of mindfulness meditation or vipassana, insight meditation, as it gets deeper and deeper, he said the next thing you encounter are these obstacles to you becoming more insightful. The discerning, the discursive mind not really wanting you to become, your mind to become a powerful tool for insight into the nature of suffering. So the obstacles or the hindrances to clear seeing of lust and of aversion and of dullness and of anxiety or worry and of doubt begin to arise. And then once those dissipate, the Buddha says, it becomes possible to look, to penetrate, to be able to use the powers of insight, of mindfulness, to penetrate the mind's very construction of self. And then you can begin to understand that self is not a solid, enduring entity, but it's rather a moment-to-moment construction of mind. And then once you begin to penetrate that and see through that, then you begin to notice also that that's the same way the mind creates reality, that what we think is real. And then once you penetrate that, then notions of self begin to fall away. And that is the point at which the Buddha began to teach or offer these teachings of factors of enlightenment. He said, once the egg is cracked open and you no longer have this fixed feeling or thought about us or me being a permanent and abiding self, but rather this continuously evolving, continuously growing, continuously changing entity, kind of like consciousness surfing a flow of experience, then you begin to, there are qualities of mind that begin to just kind of light up and become available to you. And that's what he called the Bodhgangha, the limbs of awakening. These qualities of mind that begin to just spontaneously occur, you know, a sense of interest or inquiry, really, really a hunger in the mind to learn more about the Dharma, to learn more about the nature of mind. A really powerful sense of being energized, of really being motivated to look more deeply into what's going on. What's the nature of my mind? How do I come to know what I believe to be true about myself, about others? And with that can come a certain sense of leavening or of happiness or joy or release, because you're no longer bound by these preconceived notions of who I am or how the world is or how others are, you know. So these energizing factors, these kind of yang oriented limbs of awakening, of interest and energy and rapture, you know, begin to arise. And then the ones that balance those off, the other qualities of tranquility, ease of mind, of concentration, of being able to really bring the mind to rest in a focused and sustained and calm way on a single object, whether it's the breathing or anything else, and a sense of equanimity. So those are these qualities of mind that incline one towards awakening, towards freedom. And they begin to spontaneously sprout and occur as the hindrances, as the difficulties tend to fall away. So the Buddha lays out these teachings inevitably because his talk had a beginning and a middle and an end. It was of necessity linear. And he was laying out this kind of pathway, you know, how you get from duh to, okay, this is how I might become free, right? And so inevitably as a result, because, you know, it's kind of how we learn, how we think, we inevitably come to the conclusion that yes, this is a linear process. This is how it works. There's an interesting article in yesterday's New York Times about, the title of the article is, everybody knows that you begin to lose your memory as you age. And then it said, everybody's wrong. It was written by a neuroscientist. And he provided lots of evidence, you know, research evidence showing that that's not really true. That essentially what happens as you age is you just have more and more information that you're trying to keep track of. And it takes longer to retrieve it and extract it and whatnot. And he said he's a university professor. He said, you know, I've got students in their 20s that wander into the wrong classroom, you know, or make similar kinds of errors. Can't remember where they parked their car or whatever, you know, because they're too distracted. There's too much going on in their lives. So things that we assume to be a certain way, or a certain way we assume the mind to act, is not necessarily the case. The very same thing is true with the Buddha's teaching and the Greater Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness. I think a more skillful way to understand it is that he's laying out a map. You know, and the Bodhyanga, the teaching on the limbs of awakening, you know, the great metaphor, or the metaphor, the map, is that of a tree, right? With the trunk being mindfulness. And just as a tree literally functions, you know, drawing water and nutrients up into the foliage and then creating additional mass and then sending food back down through the tree to help it grow and become bigger and stronger and feed the roots so that they can, you know, that circular process, circular ongoing process, okay, is what's going on in the consciousness all the time. Except that the problem with that linear way of thinking about it, starting from da to enlightenment or da to awakening, is that you think that when you really got it down, you know, that the consciousness always hangs out in the growth nodes at the top of the tree, right? Where the photosynthesis is going on, where the continuing growth toward a state of awakening is occurring. And that's not really such a useful way to think about this metaphor. What instead, certainly in my experience, also from the teachings that I've heard, and from my study of the texts, is that the consciousness can move around among all of these levels of awakening in a seemingly random but extremely mobile and changeable way. My friend and one of my teachers in this tradition, in the Thai forest lineage, Jack Kornfield, wrote a book once called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. And it was a book that was composed largely of interviews that he'd done with very senior Buddha Dharma yogis, some of whom were teachers, right? We've been doing this stuff 15, 20, 25 years, and had experienced different levels of realization, as described in the texts, and some of whom were acknowledged to be wise and gifted teachers, who had been teaching the Dharma on retreat and whatnot, for, you know, long periods of time. And yet, at some point, well into their lives as senior yogis and Dharma teachers and whatnot, experienced what in the Christian tradition is called the dark night of the soul. All that they thought they knew about the Dharma, about themselves, about their capabilities of, as Dharma teachers, as explainers of, as exponents of the Dharma, got called into question and in some cases utterly shattered. In some cases it was a spouse or significant other walking out on them or cheating on them. In some cases it was people who had struggled with addictions and dependencies for years, who had come clear of them, who had been sober for a couple of decades and were teaching about the Dharma and sobriety, falling off the wagon. plunging to the depths, the darkest depths, the darkest life-threatening depths of addiction once more. After they thought they were bulletproof, right? And then realizing that they had to start all over again, step by step, climbing out of the hole. What happened? They thought they were so on. They thought they really had it, and yet it turns out they didn't. And so over and over again in his book, Jack talks about these different people and how they had become inspired by the Dharma, had become an important part of their lives, had gone on to teach it, live their lives in accordance with its principles, and yet still and all at some point along the way something happened. And they felt shattered and shaken and needed to reevaluate everything. In some cases, it resulted in a really deep sense of doubt about whether they'd been on the same path, the right path all along. Sometimes it was doubt of themselves and whatnot. In every one of these cases, it required a really profound reevaluation and reinvestigation of everything they thought they knew. And everything they thought they knew, not only about the Dharma and about spiritual life, but about themselves as well. And in every one of these situations, the way Jack describes it, it was profoundly humbling, and it required them to all let go of any image they may have had about themselves as wise, you know, as erudite, as spiritually advanced or gifted. And, you know, it's like Suzuki Roshi's book in 1970, it's called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Mm-hmm. Said you always need to learn, always need to remember how to be a beginner. Yeah. Never assume that you're not a beginner. Always be able to, every time you go to sit, always be open to the idea that it's the first time you've ever sat in your life. So that there's a freshness and an interest in what's happening in the next moment. Rather than, oh yeah, you know, I've been doing this crap for 25 years now. And, oh, here comes the breath. Oh, here comes aversion. No, just sit there with bare attention, you know, and look at what's going to happen in the next moment. And so, he's just saying, be ready for anything. You know? And for me, it was a really powerful book because I read it after I'd been sitting for over 20 years and teaching for about 5 or 6. And it's like, it's very sobering. And it was a cautionary tale. And it's been I still consider that book a valuable teaching because it helps keep me grounded. You know, whenever I start to believe my, you know, it's like I think it was Jack, maybe Joseph, at one point when he was sitting with some of us who've been teaching for a while on a teacher's retreat, he said, you know, just never ever start believing your own press clippings. You know, never take too seriously anything anyone else says about you. And these are people that publish a lot of books and were very highly regarded. Yes, like, just stay grounded, stay in touch. And so, the reason that I have gone on a length about this is in order to help remind us or dissuade us from thinking about this being a linear hierarchical process. Okay, well now that I'm experiencing, you know, these factors of enlightenment, I get these flashes about the limbs of awakening, you know, the factors of awakening. Oh wow, that now that means that I've gotten beyond, you know, these hindrances or these difficulties. And so the reason it's really important to remember that that isn't really the case is that at any given time, any of us, you know, when we're sitting in meditation, whether it's here or at home or anywhere else, anything can happen at any time, you know. So if we're sitting and all of a sudden there's a real powerful aversion or anger or fear or rage or whatnot, there's this immediate tendency to say, oh wow, you know, I was just beginning to get this taste of equanimity and peace and gentle joy in my sitting, but now all of a sudden I'm experiencing this again. This must mean that I've fallen back, that I'm not as pure as I thought I was, you know. And that's really, it's an easy pattern of thought to have arise, and it's also quite erroneous, because it arises from judging ourselves and feeling like, well, since I've occasionally experienced these exalted states in the past, and now I'm not, that means I'm not really as far along as I thought I was. You know, this, that kind of a scorekeeping. You know, I thought I was, you know, far along in graduate school and getting ready to work on my dissertation, all of a sudden it turns out I can't remember my multiplication tables. You know, it's like, oh my, you know, everything is, all is lost, whatnot. It's just that if we look at this great map, you know, of the hindrances and these other difficulties, and then the mind becoming calm and insights into the empty nature of self, and then the experiencing on occasion of equanimity and calm and joy and energy and whatnot, it's like they're all jumbled up, and we think that if I don't always have my receptor tuned into these higher states, then I'm not really getting anywhere, you know. And that's such a sad thing. It's a difficult and unuseful thought to have, because in my experience, once more, it's so much more helpful to think about our consciousness, our sense of ourselves as spiritual explorers, as being able to alight or find ourselves in any of these states of mind at any time, and regarding them with an equally full sense of attention and care. Aha, here is where I've alighted now. A memory of a painful thing that happened 40 years ago. Aha, here is where I've alighted now. In a state of real, gentle, selfless, calm joy. You know, the Buddha used a lot of, in addition to this metaphor of the great tree or the limbs of awakening, you know, had a lot of similes as well. And he had similes for the different states of mind that we find ourselves in. His similes for the hindrances are things like, you know, he used the image of like a bowl of water or a little pond in a forest. You know, it's like the mind afflicted by desire is like water into which bright colored dyes have been poured that made it impossible to see the bottom. You know. The mind imbued with a sense of rage as being boiling water. The mind imbued with dullness being like a pond overgrown with algae. You know, the mind imbued with restlessness and worry being like one over the breezes were blowing over it and making it, you know, exciting the surface. The mind imbued with doubt as being one in which it was turbid, like someone had stirred up the bottom with a stick and there was full of mud. He also talked about the mind that was calm and clear as being like, and these are common in Asia, little bodies of water, ponds where there are like giant lily pads growing or lotuses growing, sometimes right on the surface and sometimes just below it. And so that even if the wind rustles or disturbs the surface, these blossoms, these lie just below, and they're just floating there. You know? He said the mind can be like that too. You know, just even though there's stuff going on up here, your consciousness can be floating just below the surface, really calm, really clear. You know. So these factors of enlightenment, you know, they seem like exalted states or ones that we should be striving for. And the Buddha said that, right, you know, once we've gotten to the point where we can recognize the difficult states of mind, and once that we've gotten to the point where we can recognize the more beneficial states of mind, he said it really can be beneficial to exert a certain amount of effort toward cultivating these qualities of awakening. You know, if you can make sure that you're doing so in a way that is not attached to outcome, in a way that is not imbued with any sense of aversion. I feel really distracted and nervous and anxious, so by God, I'm going to develop some equanimity. It's like, it doesn't really work like that, you know. But if you can recognize the mind that is distracted or anxious or worried, and then perhaps, and the one part about this being more kind of graduate level work that is worth, you know, a more advanced state of practice that really is worth paying attention to, is that for the most part, when the Buddha was teaching insight meditation or mindfulness, it was non-judgmental awareness. It was just looking at what's arising and passing away, you know, without any attempt to, you know, cling to the pleasant or push away the unpleasant. But what he said, when you start to see the arising of these factors of enlightenment, he said, it can be skillful to cultivate them as long as you can do so without attachment to outcome and without aversion to their opposite. So for instance, if you're feeling anxious, scared, nervous, worried, agitated, and the mind can recognize that that's what's going on, it can be useful as a compassionate gesture to oneself to say, aha, may I be at ease. May I be at peace with things as they are. You know, may I take in that which is, you know, the anxiety or the nervousness or the agitation. May I accept it fully for what it is and be at peace with what is. And so what he's encouraging us to do then is to, and he actually would invoke from time to time, do visualizations. He would invoke the image of the pond with the lily pads or the floating lotus blossoms. See, may my mind be as this pond of floating lotuses, so that even though the breeze is flowing across the top of the pond, the mind is still calm and the mind is still at ease and the mind is still clear. So as we begin to recognize, okay, those are factors of enlightenment. Those are limbs of awakening that he's describing. Being calm, being at ease, being at peace with things as they are, even if the way things are is disturbed, it's roused up. So it's the skillful cultivation of a factor of awakening to be a companion to the difficult, not to try to make it go away, not to expel it, not to reject it, but to say, aha, this too. I can bring this factor of awakening into being to abide with that which is difficult. And we don't have to wait until we've been sitting for 10 years or gone on 5 retreats. We can do it right now. That teaching is available to us now. And that's why it's being shared. So please, any thoughts or questions or reflections anyone may have?
Yeah. So if something is happening and your reaction is that you're feeling very agitated.
Yes.
By what's going on. I guess it could be the thoughts and then physically you feel it. So if you're observing, and I don't say this to be funny, is it being at peace with that which is going on externally or being at peace with feeling like a nervous wreck?
Thank you. Good question. And of course, this is all contextual. What I've been talking about for the most part is what happens in the mind when we're sitting. So that if you are, like maybe you have a memory of something that happened recently where you got really agitated or angry, or you were having some conflict with somebody or something was going on that was hard. And so you're reflecting on that as you sit and it may be bringing back the same feelings. Then in that sitting, you can say, oh, right, here is the mind being agitated. Here is the mind being worried or afraid or angry about something that happened. And here is, in this moment, the mind's ability to be with that in a kind and open and peaceful way. So that's a really useful practice to do in the meditative context. And the reason it's useful to do in the meditative context is that down the road, if in fact you run into the same thing, you know, and but at this time you're out on the road, you're out on the street, you know, you're in daily life and things are moving fast and your feelings are arising with, you know, with a lot of force. The training of being able to bring the peaceful state of mind to arise and be with the agitated state of mind in the meditative context can come in handy the next time that agitation arises in real life. So, in other words, the next time, if it's the same person or the same conflict or whatever it is that's going on, that instead of automatically falling into the same reactive response, there can be just a moment where you remember that state of peace from when you were sitting. It's like maybe just the taking of a breath. And you, as a result, become less reactive or less a kind of a prisoner of your own emotional reactivity going on. So anything we do in meditation is beneficial both for what's going on in the moment, but it's in some ways even more beneficial as training or preparation for what is going to happen in daily life the next time that state of mind might arise. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, I guess I'm a little, so if I hear you right, if you are meditating regularly and you get used to being that observer and recognizing what it is, that it almost becomes maybe muscle memory or...
Yes, exactly.
And until that's so, I would imagine that if you found yourself real time, feeling anxious. That even though you aren't meditating, but you notice in that moment, you could still do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Right? To help yourself.
Absolutely. The understanding in the context that, and this is an excellent follow-up question. The understanding in terms of how the mind works is that ultimately the mind can only do one thing at a time. So you find yourself drawn into a situation, you find the mind being anxious and disturbed, and you find yourself in a reactive posture. And whereas before having learned how to meditate, you would just follow through with whatever the mind was telling you to do. Now, as the power of mindfulness grows, and you, every once in a while, the mind will interject, and the mindfulness kicks in, and there's just a moment where your mind is saying, oh, here I am being anxious. Here I am being agitated. Here I am being angry. Here I am being distraught. Okay. In the moment when the mind is noticing that that's what's going on, okay, basically what the mind is noting is what was going on in the previous moment. And so when you have that moment of mindfulness, it's broken the circuit. You know, it's like one of the analogies I use these days is like, you know, if you have an HGTV and you're getting a feed and you're watching this seamless imaging on your screen, and then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, the signal is disturbed and the pixelation breaks up, right? And the whatever the drama or the comedy or whatever it is you're into, and you were completely sucked into it, all of a sudden the screen is nothing more than this pattern of colored squares. It's like, damn, you know, I was really enjoying that, you know, or I was really sucked up in that. But then all of a sudden it's just a bunch of colored squares. And that's a little bit like what mindfulness is doing. It's breaking up the pattern, it's breaking up the signal, it's saying, oh wow, I was so into that soap opera, and now I can see it's just a bunch of colored squares, you know, that were configuring themselves into anger, fear, or whatever. In some ways, it's kind of a bummer because it breaks up the entertainment factor of the, you know, whatever the drama was. It may have been lust, it may have been rage, it may have been any one of a number of things, or some documentary, you know, but all of a sudden mindfulness comes along and spoils the plot, you know, because it's, oh, Christ, oh, here I am in the moment, right? And noticing what I was watching a minute ago. And so it you know, it kind of spikes the entertainment value, but at the same time, it brings us right back into the moment, and it gives us incredible power that we didn't have before, because up until that moment, we were just passive observers of whatever it was that was going on. But then all of a sudden in that moment, it's like we have total control. Oh, there was rage. There was, you know, there was terror, there was fear, there was whatever. And now, there's nothing but mindfulness. And then, of course, the signal may kick in, and then, you know, but then again, and the reason we call it practice, the more we do this stuff, the better the mind gets at interrupting the signal. The mind gets better and better at interrupting the signal, especially at times when we're causing ourselves a lot of pain. And that's where the Buddha's teaching, you know, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the cessation of suffering. And everyone figures, well, you know, as soon as I start meditating, I'm going to stop suffering. What happens is that you start meditating, the more you meditate, the better you get at recognizing when the mind is causing suffering. And so to some extent it's a real bummer because it's really painful, but you recognize, oh good God, you know, here the mind is doing this really unfortunate thing again. But it also is, along with the pain comes real freedom. And real kind of compassion, you know. Oh my goodness, here's the mind just doing this automatic thing again. But now I recognize it, and now I can keep it from, or I can weaken its ability to keep doing it in the future. Okay, one more, then we have to go home. Yeah, please.
Two things. One, I only recently became aware of the sequels of the 10 mind beginners. Not Always So is another book of Suzuki Roshi's books, just as enchanting as the first.
Yeah,
so
good, thank you.
Not equally popular.
Yep.
Yeah. Very good. And the other thing I want to say is just that the difficulty that even when I come to recognize something and name and identify it, and things or well-established patterns, I find that that doesn't immediately produce the kind of relief from the anxiety and fear or whatever it is I'm experiencing that I had hoped for. Yeah. That step from recognition and identification to resolution or calming is a huge step for me. I don't know whether it is for other people.
Yeah. In my own teaching lineage, there one of the Thai forest meditation masters, Ajahn Chah, said that on this Buddha Dharma path, one of the things that makes it difficult, not so easy, one of the reasons why it's not wildly popular, whether in Thailand or anywhere else in the world or here, is that once the mind begins to awaken, there is this extended period within which we become ever more acutely aware of how the mind creates dukkha and yet remain powerless to keep it from happening. So, you know, the adage in this tradition is that suffering is the gateway to compassion. And so what he's saying and what all the teachers basically say is that this pathway, you know, that it is unfortunate but necessary to move through this period when we become increasingly aware and increasingly insightful into how the mind creates dukkha and yet remain powerless to do anything about it. The more we watch that process occur, the greater the growth of compassionate regard for a situation, and the greater the growth of compassionate regard for a situation becomes, to that extent, we begin to disempower the mind's reactive creation of suffering. Because we just see over and over how much it hurts. No more complicated than the little kid with her hand on the stove. Wow, that really hurts. I really ought to take my hand off the stove. One of these days I will. And so gradually we do. But we do it at our own pace. We do it as we're able. And in the meanwhile, we hold ourselves. We witness the suffering. Thank you. And now it really is time for us to go home. So let's take our sitting posture once more. Settle in. Allow the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Maybe live with ease and know ease of well-being, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we regard ourselves and each other with patience and compassion. With generosity and kindness of heart. May we be happy, may we be at peace, and may we awaken and be free. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah.